everyone, welcome back to the Earthdawn Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters. With your questers, Josh and Dan, I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things quizzical, as we have another email palooza for you here, some short ones, some long ones, all kinds of ones in between. And other than that, if you have a question for us, please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. Any updates you want to give the listeners, Josh, before we get into the emails?
As a follow-up to last week's episode about the Threads adventure from Parlength Adventures, we weren't sure whether Sam Witt had written anything else.
Yeah.
The episode went live today as we are recording this, and Lou shared earlier that Sam did in fact contribute. He said he was pretty sure that he wrote the wizard essay in Adept's Way.
Oh, nice.
And an entry or two in the horrors book, and did probably a couple of like the legends in those early Legends of Earthdawn books. That he was somebody who like didn't do a whole book, but was one of those folks who would contribute a couple of smaller things to those sort of collection pieces.
Nice. We give credit where credit is due. We'll absolutely chime.
He had worked on some other stuff, but was not as prolific a contributor as some of the other folks, or as well known a contributor as some of the other folks that we have talked about in those pieces.
No, but a bang up job when he did nonetheless. Absolutely. So we have something here from Alan. We just need to comment on this because we got your journal of Val d'Or, and awesome job. It is a 64-page PDF that we will not be reading on the podcast because that'll take up three episodes worth of time.
Yeah, it's a covers basically the adventures that we have been going over in the Parlength Adventure series. My understanding, I have not had time to read the whole thing.
I have not.
I pulled it up and started reading like the first. I'm like, okay, yeah, cool. It's cool. I really like seeing adventure journals and the character voice that can sometimes come across in them.
Yes.
I still have somewhere the journals that my players wrote in my long-term Earthdawn game that I talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I still have those somewhere. Because one of the things that was the genesis of my personal website was posting those journal entries, because that was something that we did back in the late
'90s. Early years.
Yeah. You know, back in the days of the Strands website and whatnot.
I remember the Strands website.
James Sutton, yeah. I'm sorry. I sort of first came across him from his Earthdawn character journals, campaign journals being posted to his website. That sort of stuff was a big thing back in the day when everybody kind of just had their own personal sites and whatnot. And so I posted a bunch of them, didn't get them all up, but I still have those. Yeah, it's really cool. I like to see them.
Oh, yeah. No, this will be some good reading when I have more time to absorb that. Because
time, again, what is time? What is time like, Dan? What is free time?
Free time is the same thing as spare money.
Ah.
I'll do this in my free time when I have some spare money.
That I actually have a little bit of familiarity with for not great reasons, but that's...
Not great reasons, yes. Understood. Understood. I got a Christmas bonus that I've just now used up all of. So, yeah, I'm with you there. But, yeah, otherwise, Alan says, hey, I was going to split this into chapters to represent the various adventures that will be covered over the next few episodes. But I said, what the hell, just send the whole schmozzle. So, for your reading pleasure, love the podcast. Earthdawn forever, Alan. So thank you, Alan. We'll get to it when we actually have a free minute in our spare time with our free money. So yeah, one of those things. But I absolutely deeply appreciate all your hard work putting that together. I'm pretty sure your players do too.
Or if you are a player, I'm sure your GM appreciates it.
And if they're not awarding you legend points for that, they should be, because I always did. If you give me a journal, I'll throw you some extra legend points your way because you put effort forth and put it in character voice. So I'm all good there. So yeah.
I did that too.
Totally. So we got one from Brendan. Hi, Dan. Hi, Josh. On the subject of nighttime, wilderness ambushes while a party is resting, is there any penalty for members of the party sleeping in their armor? Does it depend on the armor? How long do you think it should take an adept to put on their armor? Thanks for all the hard work you both do. Brendan.
I actually thought about this a little bit. There is not anything in the rules specifically about penalties for sleeping in your armor. I will say, first of all, that I don't think that anything I'm about to say will apply to Blood Pebble or Living Crystal, because both of those are armors that are implanted and are sort of designed to not be taken off. That's part of the reason why Blood Pebble ends up being such a popular armor, because it's a decent balance between physical and mystic, and you also never get caught without it. I think the number,
it's
like,
the best.
You know, a lot of, like, after the first night ambush, a lot of folks are like, well, I don't want to get caught without my armor again. I'm going to invest some Blood Pebble. I know, like, certainly that the Swordmaster in my long-term game got Blood Pebble after the first night ambush that they had. That said, I think there absolutely should be penalties for sleeping in armor. This is just sort of me thinking about it for half an hour earlier.
Mm-hmm.
My gut thought would be that if you spend the night sleeping in your armor, that you get penalized on your recovery tests the next day based on the initiative penalty of the armor.
That makes sense. I like that as a game balance.
Those numbers are kind of roughly equivalent. And so if you're effectively, because you're in armor heavy enough that it uses up all of your initiative penalty, then at that point you actually would probably, I would like start saying, hey, you need to like deal with exhaustion, like start dealing with that sort of thing. That's probably where I go. My only minor issue with that is the armors that don't actually have an initiative penalty, but those are all minor enough that, again, this was just off the top of my head. I might even shift it as to say as like penalized one plus the initiative penalty in terms of recovery tests. So that if you are sleeping in your armor for armor that is, again, not Blood Pebble or Living Crystal, you are going to at least lose a recovery test for doing that because you are sleeping in something that is not really designed to do that.
Yeah.
But again, that's like not thinking about it super hard and checking to see if there are any weird edge cases that come out as a result of that.
No, let's do this real quick. Cause I'm looking at the armor table right now, the initiative penalty that has a zero, Espagra cloak. Fine.
Fern
weave. Fine. Leather. Fine. Obsidian skin. Who's wearing that? Padded cloth and padded leather have no initiative penalty. Those are all soft armors. You actually could sleep in those without a penalty.
Well,
relatively soft.
Historically speaking, leather armor.
Yes.
Actual leather armor. You're talking about something like, I think one of the terms for it is like cuirbouillie, which is boiled leather, which is hard.
Stiff.
It's not like a leather jacket or something. That's more like
padded leather. Yeah, it's more like suede in this case.
That was like a quick and dirty, well, what are some existing numbers that I could pull from to deal with that?
No, I'm okay with that. Like I said, I think your answer of plus one makes more sense, because that way there's always at least one penalty.
Yeah, because armor is not something really that is designed to be slept in.
No, I don't want to be sleeping in chainmail. That's uncomfortable.
Yeah, one plus the initiative penalty, it is going to be uncomfortable, which honestly, like, makes the magical armors that reduce the initiative penalty to a certain extent, like, if you're going to go that way, even better, because then they sort of have, like, that magical bit of whatever to make them a little bit more comfortable, easier to move in.
Yeah.
Again, this doesn't apply to the implanted armors, because you can't do anything about those. As far as the amount of time that it would take for somebody to put on armor if they wake up and want to do so, I don't know. At that point, I might start looking at the piecemeal armor rules.
Yeah, fair.
Making a call on, again, like looking at armor values and trying to figure out something that would make sense within the context of how these things would actually be put on. And again, I did not look at this, and so this is really just off the top of my head. I would probably come up with something that is based on the armor, like the physical armor rating of the armor would be like the determining factor in how long it would take. And my thing that I'm not sure of is how that would convert from that armor value to
rounds
and then maybe looking at the piecemeal armor rules, which talk about like small, medium, and large pieces. And so it would be possible perhaps for someone who like normally wears chain, right, mm-hmm. to just throw on their chain hauberk, like not do the greaves, not do just to get a little bit of armor protection on so they don't get the full suit. That's a, I need to sit down with an hour.
Plot that out.
Take a look at values and figure out something that makes sense while also looking at the actual, like how much time it actually, I'd probably talk to my, like to some SCA friends and say, hey, yeah, sure. How long does it actually take to get into your armor?
Yeah.
Use that as some kind of basis. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I would go with it, but I really like my sleeping in armor thing. I am a lot less sure about the other one, but that's probably where I would go with it.
Yeah.
If I had to really like sit down and consider and come up with rules.
Totally. I've only encountered one RPG ever in my lifetime that actually has a list of here's how long it takes to put on armor in rounds. So if you were going to do that for this one game, I only know of one game, but you're much more well-read on these than I am.
I'm pretty sure somewhere in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons expanded rulebook stuff, there is a table that talks about how long it takes to don or doff armor.
Yeah, I don't have those books.
I want to say it's probably either in the Wilderness Survival Guide or Dungeoneer Survival Guide. Like that. Like my brain is saying, that's probably where it is, but I could be wrong.
Fair.
I feel like it's something that got talked about like around swimming rules, because if you fall into water wearing armor, it's kind of important to know how long it's going to take you to take it off.
Yeah. Then you're hosed.
So it's possible it's somewhere right around there. But I know like that kind of information is sort of out there. But I also don't know like AD&D, there are aspects of it that are accurate and other aspects where they were just completely making up stuff whole cloth. And I have no idea whether the values that they used for that sort of stuff there have any actual basis in reality.
Yeah.
But I would base it more on, well, here's how much protection it provides. To get the full protection, it's going to take you this amount of time, and not mm-hmm. necessarily be super concerned with, does it pass the smell test? Does it make enough sense for this to kind of be good enough that we can use the numbers that are already existing to kind of determine that and go from there? I much prefer that sort of thing, like I did with the sleeping in armor. Like, oh, here's a value that measures in a decent way how effective this would be at hindering such a thing. So let's use that as the value to go on from there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Insight into the
creative process.
Yeah. The creative process, designer's mind kind of thing.
Totally.
Hopefully I will like remember that for the future and maybe at some point like work it up. Maybe come up with something a little bit more detailed, but I make no promises in that regard.
No need to remember it. We've just recorded it. It's all written. It's all recorded for you.
That would require me to go back and listen to the past episodes once we posted them. I don't do that very often. I do that with some episodes.
Free time. Free time.
Like I go back and I go, this, I like go back and listen. I'm like, actually, that was a really good episode. I like that.
You notice out of the 215, there's not a lot of those where Josh is like, I like that one.
Well, no, I mean, I like all of them.
I know.
You
know.
I wouldn't be doing this if there were like a bunch that I didn't like. It's just, I have to go through them like three times before they're posted. Once when we do the initial recording and a couple of times to do the editing and then the show notes and whatnot. So I like hear them a bunch.
Oh, yeah. You and me both. I'm like, oh, I've listened to this twice now. We're good. So onto a longer email from Kenneth from Denmark. Hi, Kenneth. Welcome to the show. I believe this is your first time emailing us. If it's not, I apologize for forgetting. Hello, Josh and Dan. We are a group of six guys in our mid-40s who meet physically every 2 weeks to play Earthdawn. We started out with D&D more than 5 years ago, but switched to Earthdawn 4th edition half a year ago. Three of us played Earthdawn 1st edition back in the 90s and had good memories from then, so we decided to try it out again. I play Snip, a windling wizard following Florenius, who was born in the care of Underdale. After 30 years in Underdale, we found out that there was a secret way out of Underdale, which our leader Gorm Lightbringer was using on a weekly basis to visit the city of Dale above. We managed to escape and started creating our legend in Dale before returning to Underdale to free our families and friends from Gorm Lightbringer. Afterwards, we formed the group of Vanguard of the forgotten and are on a mission to free people from slavery and forgotten cares. We really enjoyed the constant progression of ranking up talents and the freedom of choice in building a unique character. Mechanically, Earth Dawn is far superior to other systems we have experienced with, and we really enjoyed the exploding dice. Done! Love it.
Mission accomplished.
Yes. We
close it up, folks.
Earth Dawn wins. Okay. And this is that which is understood need not be explained. Okay. My comments are done. We have agreed on a couple house rules that I'm really happy with and would like to share and hear your thoughts on. Two house rules. One, when thread weaving and scoring two additional successes on maybe a thread weaving difficulty 7, you have to roll a 17, so that's two more. It is allowed to cast the spell in the same round as it was woven. The reason for this change was that the thread weaving around is not really that exciting and has only rolled where additional successes do not really benefit anyone. We still use the thread weaving knacks if the thread weaving did not have two additional successes.
If that's what you want to do, that's fine. And I understand, especially if you're coming to Earth Dawn from other systems that have a different mechanical foundation for spellcasting, how it can feel that the magician, the spellcaster, doesn't necessarily feel like they are contributing a lot. And that's fine, and I understand that. I think for the vast majority of games, it's probably not going to be a huge issue. My only sort of concern with that is that, and again, for most games, unless your game's going to be getting up into like the 13th to 15th circle range, where you get access to a talent that is specifically designed to allow you to weave threads and cast a spell in the same round.
Yeah.
You know, okay, that talent then no longer requires you to get that those extra successes.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of things to also keep in mind. I'm scattered all over the place on this one. One.
Fair.
He mentioned that he was already using knacks, I think.
Yeah, they said if they have the knack to allow something along these lines, they will use those. But in the case that character does not have the knack, then on the off chance that they happen to get.
Yeah, there were a bunch of spellcasting knacks that were introduced in The Companion.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a bunch more that are going to be in Deeper Secrets when that finally comes out here in another couple of months-ish.
Yeah.
Hopefully sooner rather than later.
Agreed.
I've been cranking away at the layout on that. That allow a magician to do a minor-ish effect for free on a round that they are weaving threads. Nothing that is as powerful as a spell of equivalent circle, but that basically allows them to feel like they are contributing something more beyond just, okay, well, I'm going to continue to weave threads.
Yeah.
La-da-da. Extra successes on thread weaving tests when you start getting into spells that have multiple threads. Those extra successes weave extra threads. You would definitely want to make sure that you're factoring that into things when you get into higher circles and have some of those spells. It's okay. Like, if that's working for your group or whatever, that's fine. I would just kind of maybe keep an eye on it and make sure that it's not giving too much to the magicians in comparison to the other disciplines.
Yeah, fair. We did something like this in my group in the first, second, and third edition as well. Since we didn't have the extra successes, we had to do the extraordinary success.
Yeah.
And since it was so rare and two extra successes is going to be fairly rare, it didn't seem to throw off the game balance a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, two extra successes is essentially what in previous editions would have been an excellent success.
Yeah.
The one that like was the armor defeating hit.
Yes, yes, yes.
It'll happen from time to time, but not all the time.
Yeah.
I certainly prefer that to the, if you've woven all the threads, then you can cast the spell the same round. There's a reason that we have zero thread spells available. That if you feel like you want to cast a spell every round, you can do so. And then when you get into journeyman circles and have your enhanced matrices, you can
take care of that.
Do those with one thread spells.
Yes.
It does in some ways kind of limit what you're able to do.
Mm-hmm.
The limiting factor is really the number of matrices that you have. That's your limiting factor in terms of safe spell casting. So I don't know. I don't think it's a huge problem. And if it's working for you and it doesn't seem to be unbalancing and the group's having a good time,
Go for it.
Thumbs up.
Yeah. And again, if you didn't bring up the zero thread spells, I was going to remind you about them. But yes, valid, perfect point to make about the zero thread spells. That's why they're there. Okay. House rule number two. Legend point cost for spells has been removed as the spellcasters get too far behind the rest of the group if they choose all of the spells they can possibly buy with legend points. Many fun and situational spells are not learned if they cost legend points.
This is something that I've kind of gone back and forth on, because first edition didn't have spells themselves cost legend points to learn. You just could learn them.
Yeah.
Second edition did introduce legend point costs for learning spells.
Mm-hmm.
Classic and third edition did not have a legend point cost for learning spells. We did introduce them back in fourth edition. And if you don't want to do them, that's okay. But a couple of things that I want to put forward. I don't think it actually ends up putting casters as far behind as people fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible, depending on what other things that the group is spending legend points on, and I'm talking about all of the characters, not just the magicians, yes. It's possible that the magician characters could be, when the group at large is like qualifying and achieving fourth circle, the magicians may not be quite that close to it. I don't think that the difference is hugely dramatic. And I also think that from a balancing standpoint, that each additional spell provides an additional tool in the toolkit for the magician to solve problems or address issues, and the versatility that that provides, having some kind of investment that needs to be made into that to build your character is worthwhile. I remember running the numbers a while back,
mm-hmm.
looking at just the player's guide. How many legend points would it actually cost to learn all of the spells that are in the book? And how many talent ranks? Because that's sort of the compare. That's what falling behind effectively means there.
Agreed.
Is that you are not able to buy your talents up at the same rate as, say, the warrior or the swordmaster or the troubadour or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How many talent ranks are you effectively costing yourself by learning spells instead of advancing your talent ranks? And in the grand scheme of things, I honestly don't feel like it is a huge deal, especially once you start getting into journeyman circles. And there is so much that you can spend legend points on.
Yeah.
From thread items to group patterns to knacks to all sorts of stuff that kind of starts becoming available at that tier.
Mm-hmm.
If you are looking at it at a pure, I want to advance in circles as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
It is absolutely possible for somebody to advance ahead of their other folks who are going wide instead of tall.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of pull the parallel there.
Yeah.
I have run into people who do that, broadly speaking, in the community that I sort of interface with online, on the Discord, at conventions and so forth. People generally accept that and have not found it to be as big of a problem as many of them have expected when they sort of first encountered that. Again, if that's what your group wants to do, that's fine, and it doesn't seem to be otherwise unbalancing things.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool, great, whatever. But those are sort of the reasons why it's in there. Is that the variety of abilities that magicians get access to through their spells should probably cost something in terms of character investment. Otherwise, you are effectively getting free power boosts.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that can unbalance magicians in relation to other character types.
Mm-hmm.
The magicians can get access, potentially, if you don't cost legend points for those, get access to a whole bunch of tools and tricks and power enhancements, even if they're not necessarily vertical power enhancements, but horizontal, like broad power enhancements that other disciplines don't get access to.
Yeah. Especially if they're free.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. If you're getting those for free, all you have to do is track them down and maybe pay some money to somebody.
Yep.
That's kind of a no-brainer at that point. requiring legend points, yeah, oh, well, maybe there are utility spells that don't end up getting learned and used because they cost legend points. By the time you're hitting fifth or sixth circle, the amount of legend points that it costs to pick up a first or second circle spell compared to how much it costs you to raise one of your talent ranks 1 point,
yeah,
is pretty minor. That cost curve gets pretty steep. It's the same reason that multidisciplining starts to be so attractive to a certain point, is that the amount of power boost that you can get for investing legend points into something else.
Yeah.
For the amount of legend points that it costs me to go from sixth to seventh circle, I can learn a whole second discipline and bring it up all the way to fifth.
Yeah.
And get so many more toys and tools and abilities and powers.
Mm-hmm.
That versatility should cost something.
Well, it's always the trade-off between spells and talents. That's pretty much it. And so if you actually spend the points on the talent or that circle, the new circle spell, and spend more points, when you have 200 or 300 left over, you're like, I really can't spend these on anything. That's when you go back to your first and second circle spells and buy those. So get the expensive stuff first, then go back and get the cheap stuff.
Well, this is not like magic theory wise how it works, but from a mechanical standpoint, I also like to think of it as a spell that you learn sort of being like a spellcasting knack. It is a special ability that is sort of tied to this. And just like knacks cost legend points to learn as a one-time cost, a spell likewise, like a unique twist or a different way of using something, you know, should cost as well. So that's kind of like some of the design thinking behind that. And again, if it's working for your group and it doesn't seem to be unbalancing things or whatever,
keep it.
Great. Have a good time.
Yeah.
That's my thinking and why we went with it in fourth edition.
Fair enough.
And that is a little bit traded off with the fact that you do get those free spell matrices.
Yes.
Like how much of a rebate that is up to the individual, but it's basically something that you don't have to invest points into.
Agreed. Yeah. The free spell matrices are just, that was one of the beautiful fourth edition things. Love those. So Kenneth closes by saying, I have now heard all your podcasts, at least the game mechanical ones. As I leave the lore to our game master with Magic Deeper Secrets on the way, I am hoping we can get a podcast with the fifth to eighth circle spells before the release. Thanks for everything you do for the Earthdawn community.
It's not going to happen before the release, but it is certainly something that we could talk about. In fact, when Deeper Secrets maybe comes out, maybe we could go back and like revisit the lower circle, because these are all new options that are available to those novice spellcasters. And we can kind of talk about those.
Yes.
Some of which will be new. Some of which will be like returning spells from earlier editions and whatnot.
Totally.
There's a lot of content in that book. It is going to be a very big book. And I like broadly hope people will be happy with it.
Agreed. And I think we can mine, you know, 5 or 10 episodes of content from it. So
somebody on the Discord, when learning that something was not going to be in that book, were like, oh, well, I kind of wish that they had split it into two books in order to make room for everything. And I'm like, yeah, that's just what we need. We put one book out and say, oh, well, we don't have everything yet. There's another book coming. Let's give people even more reason to complain about the fact that they don't have everything yet.
Yes.
I would much rather get that out of the way and say, like, here. Have Here's this everything. Massive tome of just about everything else that you could possibly want. Like, yeah, there are some things that are missing and they may find a space somewhere in the future, but get all those spells into people's hands and maybe they will keep quiet about not having enough spells for, you know, a few months.
Yeah, make them happy. Okay, we have a longer email. This is going to wrap up the entire episode, but it's going to take the last half of the episode, I promise you. This is a meaty one. We get this from Stefan. So this is the Enchanting Deep Dive. Strap in. Here we go. Hey, Josh and Dan. In episode 103, this is 218. Really? 150? Anyway, episodes later. In episode 103,
look, not everybody has been with us from the beginning.
Well, I have. Kidding.
Well, you have. That's not kidding. What are you talking about?
That's the joke. In episode 103, you asked to suggest an example of an enchantment to discuss the enchantment process a little more. From my point of view, there are two perspectives on this, that of the players and that of the game masters. That's why I'm sending you an example of both. Here's the perspective from the player. A Nethermancer learns the enchantment Naxx from his master during his ascendance to the fifth circle by his master, making a magic wand together with him. The following ingredients are available for the enchantment. A thigh bone of a double ogre leader, killed by the group. A magically highly charged crystal from the time before the plague. Super rare, approximately 5,000 silver coins of value. A bone spirit with the usual stats and powers of rank 5 to support the enchanter. The bone carving skill at a rank of 2 and lots of small stuff. In addition, the master, circle 7, assists with the enchantment. The wand should contain a standard matrix and otherwise resemble the magic wand from the Game Master Manual with 4 ranks and bonuses to thread weaving and spellcasting. The formula for the enchantment is known by the master. Here's the perspective from the Game Master.
So we'll come back to that. Let's kind of take this in chunks. The enchanting rules that are included in the companion are for that idea that if a player character decides that they want to make an item of their own, whether for their own use or for one of their companions. Here is a mechanical process that you sort of, if you want to, can follow to do that. And the recipes for all of the, most of the items are available already in there. Here's how much it's going to cost. Like, you need to come up with some unique items and things like that. And then presumably, like, depending on the item, either the group may have already done the things to gather the items or might need to go out and farm the materials, so to speak, in order to get what they want. And that's fine. And sort of from a player character's perspective, hey, I want to play an enchanter. I want to make this item. Maybe depending on like the game balance, the story of needing to gather the materials and where those came from with the mechanical aspects and the time required in order to make that. That's all cool. That's fantastic. And yeah, that's sort of what the intention is for those. There is space within it for making your own items beyond those that are already created in terms of the recipes or enchanting patterns, as they're technically called in the book. But I prefer recipe just because I think it makes it a little bit clearer and doesn't use the word pattern for
another thing.
Three quarters of the magic rules. That's fine. And obviously, once you kind of get outside that area that's already been filled in, you're a little bit more on your own and needing to be creative in terms of coming up with what might seem balanced and stuff like that. I think the guidelines are pretty decent. But yeah, that's absolutely sort of from a player character creating an item direction. That is exactly what you'd be looking for.
Totally. So from the Game Master, since we've been playing Earthdawn for so long, all the official items are more or less familiar to my players. That's why I usually distribute legendary items I've developed myself to my players and the NPCs. You are also welcome to discuss the topic of enchantment with one of them. Bone loyalty. The troll nethermancer, Aramek, I'm hoping I'm saying that right, it's a made-up name, always used the same spirit for his bone circle spell for many years, so that he built up a relationship with it and also named it. With his consent, he developed a ritual and object to summon it better, which he used for the bone circle bones on his travels. Over time, Denmain was able to animate the bones and travel with Aramek as an animated skeleton, air quotes. The artifact consists of a noble red velvet bag filled with several bones of name givers that have been elaborately engraved with magical runes. The amount of bones corresponds roughly to that of a human skeleton. All 216 of them, I guess. The bag is the actual item. Lost or destroyed bones can be replaced over time so that enough are available for the ritual. However, the name giver bones must be skillfully crafted by the owner and have been in the bag for at least one lunar cycle in order to function.
Yeah, so we're not going to go through. He actually provided with this email, like the actual thread ranks and whatnot for, and like key knowledges and stuff for the items. We're not going to go through all of those.
No.
What you're talking about here from enchanting, quote unquote, from the Game Master perspective is if you are making an item yourself that the group is going to find in the course of an adventure or whatever, the actual enchanting rules from the companion don't matter.
Yeah.
What you are looking at there is using the thread item sort of guidelines that are in the thread items chapter of the Game Master's book, saying here are bonuses that are appropriate for these ranks, here are bonuses that are appropriate for these ranks, and so on. But the more important part, and I think this item illustrates it really, really well,
yes,
is the story behind the item. Like, maybe you come up with the item and you say, okay, here's like the story behind it, because a big part of the attraction of the way that magic items, thread items work in Earthdawn, especially with ones that you find, and a big theme of the game is learning about the history and past of these items so that you can bond yourself to them more strongly to gain more power. And so this item, as the thread ranks progress, the bonuses that it provides get better and better. It does certain things, like it starts off as it's a matrix. There's sort of like a deed involved. He actually has, I'm not sure whether it's actually intended to be a deed at each rank, but like once you get into like rank 3 and up, it's always like, oh, you need to carve and add more bones to the pouch. Again, depending on the game and whatnot, whether the item itself and the discovery of the key knowledges ends up being a focal point of the game, or whether it ends up being something that's kind of a side arc, or is like kind of subplot to a certain extent. Just like the item itself and its story can become part of the narrative of the game as it develops. The story here on this one is really kind of cool, and it results in an interesting, it didn't seem to me to be overly powerful item that just has a little bit of neat flavor and something that's a little bit different and provides access to some things that are a little bit outside the normal bounds of how bone circles and bone spirits work and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a really cool for that. So yeah, absolutely. From a game master perspective, that's what you're looking for, is to come up with an interesting story and how you can connect the information in that story to those key knowledge thread ranks in order to learn more about the item and progress its story and things like that.
Yeah. You should have a story behind all of these, because that's the whole point of it having a name and a history, and you have to learn all of that.
You don't just find a +1 sword. You find Kegel's sword. You find
Lorm's axe.
Lorm's axe. These items have names and history and whatnot. They may have a greater or lesser prominence in terms of the focus on them at different points in the game. There is absolutely a balancing act that you might need to do when you've got multiple thread items and you've got a more experienced group, and how much time you are focusing on them needing to do stuff to learn stuff about the items, as opposed to following the quote unquote main plot of the adventure or of the campaign. That gets into a whole other play style thing that I recognize can be a little bit troublesome maybe to deal with from time to time. But yeah, absolutely. He sent a second item along, and I don't know that we need to talk about it as well, because it's just the same thing. Like, here is a cool story that kind of connects to an item, and the bonuses that it provides are tied into that story. And so you get this interplay between the item's history and how those aspects of its history manifest in the powers of the item, so that it's not just a list of stat bonuses that you get.
Yeah.
With this bone circle pouch, as I build the relationship with the spirit that's kind of connected to these, if I swear sort of the same oath with the spirit that it had with the previous or with the original owner, it can sort of start to do the things that the legend described of what it could do.
Agreed.
Provides bonuses to casting Bone Circle and, to some of the other stuff that's going on there.
Yeah. But no, I think he wove a nice deft balance between story, which by all means, keep doing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And good bonuses without being overpowered, because I think the enchanting flow chart kind of tells you, here's what you can kind of assess with where that power level needs to be at each rank and so forth. So I think he's done a magnificent job with both of these.
The only piece of it that, like, you can sort of get a little bit of cross-pollination on this here, and this is not something that's really addressed in the rules at all, but a lot of people have expressed interest over the years in, how do I make my items I want my character to start with his father's sword, and mm-hmm. I want it to become a thread item through the course of the game.
Yeah.
How do I go about that? And
fair.
There is where you kind of need to have the perhaps taking some inspiration from the enchanting rules in terms of special materials or stuff that might need to be done, and the story that needs to be constructed around these things, and maybe having some stuff that is maybe already pre-existing that you discover, and then how to expand beyond that. That is something that has sort of been in the back of my mind as an area to tackle at some point, and I'm just not completely sure what shape that might take.
Fair. Totally fair.
But so, yeah, that's really good. Like I fantastic, fantastic email, fantastic points, different ways of approaching the idea of enchanting as in like creating
yes.
magic items, thread items
from whole cloth. Yeah. I mean, at least there's a flow chart, there's a recipe in the books. By all means, use it. This is a wonderful example in exactly how to do so. So back this one up, play it again for anybody who wants to do this again. Follow his recipe because it's right there in the enchanting section in the book. You can find it out. So Stefan just says, keep on going with the good work. And thanks for all the fish. Best regards from Vasgothia.
All right.
And thanks for all the fish, everyone. Of course, Douglas Adams. Got to give it out to Douglas Adams. So, folks, if you have any questions for us, by all means, please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. As you can tell, we do lots of email palooza episodes. We just answer your questions, get the information straight from Josh, thoughts, and go from there. So, yeah, let us know how we're doing. Any final thought, Josh?
No. Keep the questions coming.
Please.
We go through waves like where we'll get a bunch of questions all at once, and then we'll kind of be dry for a little bit. And I think just kind of saving them up and doing them as these works better because then it's easier to find them as email episodes rather yeah. than, oh, in this episode, like in the first 15 minutes, we cover an email and then go on to another topic. I think it makes it a little bit easier to find stuff when you're kind of like looking back through the archives, clearly delineating like what each episode's topic is, as opposed to like mixing them together like we did in the early days.
Yeah, it only took us 100 and some odd episodes to figure this out, but we're getting there. We can be taught. So until next time, folks, go enchant something for your legend.
Good night, everybody.